This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Chua Ng Tik. China's Xinjiang region has long been a troubled hotspot. The government is drafting a counter-terrorism law that would allow any unauthorized religious activity to be deemed extremist. This surely won't sit well with the Xinjiang majority ethnic Uyghur population, who are Muslim. To discuss the government's ongoing campaign to quell dissent and the likely Uyghur reaction to that, we are joined on the phone from Hong Kong by Amnesty International's William Ni. William, can you tell us briefly about the historical reasons behind the Uyghurs' dissatisfaction with Beijing?
Well, many Uyghurs are dissatisfied with what is going on right now. There are many Han Chinese who are moving into the area of the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. And many Uyghurs are concerned that they're being denied economic opportunities. There's a lot of employment discrimination where firms in the private sector won't hire Uyghurs because they say their language ability isn't good enough, in Mandarin, that is, even though many of them do actually have very good Mandarin skills. But, rather than Han Chinese needing the Uyghur language for jobs, they complain that they're the ones who need to know Chinese. And then there are also concerns that their culture and history and language are being suppressed to some extent. So I think those are the main things. And then also in recent years, there's concerns that, with the deteriorating security situation, that there are instances of miscarriages of justice. And there's a Strike Hard campaign going on right now, which is also worsening things.
The official stance from Beijing is that they're trying to curb extremism or terrorism, and this translates into trying to eliminate any expression of the Uyghur community Muslim identity. Is the situation in Xinjiang worse than Tibet because of this fears of Islamic radicalization?
Well, it's difficult to compare, what's going on right now in Xinjiang and Tibet. And I don't know if we can say which is worse. But I do think that because there are more security concerns in the Shuar, it is becoming very difficult for Uyghurs to peacefully express themselves. And probably the best example of this is the Uyghur scholar Ilham Toti, who was a professor in Beijing and ran a website called Uyghur Online, which tried to get news and information about the Xinjiang and about Uyghurs in both Uyghur and Chinese, and tried to disseminate it to people in China to let more intellectuals and lawyers know about it, as well as people in the international community. And last year, he was sentenced to life in prison for separatism. Now, there's no evidence that he ever engaged in any violence or had planned any terrorist activities or things like that. So this shows the extent that the government is willing to go to snuff out independent voices. But at the same time, it is probably worth mentioning that the government does confront a security challenge, and there have been instances of violence against civilians. The Chinese government does have an obligation to protect its citizens, but the manner in which it's doing it, it just seems to be creating, more problems.
What has been the impact of Toti's imprisonment?
Well, it's difficult to say what his impact is. Toti is not necessarily a household name in the region. So I don't think it had a huge impact in terms of the average man on the street, perhaps. However, I would say that in maybe the more Uyghur intellectual communities, it probably has served to polarize people. And I think the message was, even loyal dissent, people who go out of their way to try to, present constructive criticism that the government can hopefully accept, will not be tolerated, and that you really have to adhere to the government's version of policy, and otherwise, you will be sentenced. So from that point of view, it may be, sending people to further forms of radicalization.
There are two separate groups, the East Turkestan Islamic Movement and the East Turkestan Liberation Organization. Both are calling for independence. How does Beijing view these two groups?
Well, I think for a long time, Beijing has classified them as terrorist organizations, and they've sought the cooperation of the international community on those that issue. So, you know, I think that their stance has long been clear that they, you know, have tried to promote these organizations as terrorist organizations, and you know, they've claimed that they're usually behind many of the incidents that we see. But the difficult thing for researchers like us or for international media organizations is that it's very difficult to verify the facts in many of these cases. You know, first of all, many foreign reporters who travel in the region are heavily tailed the whole time by state security. They're not able to talk to people or independently verify facts about certain incidents. So it's difficult to know what's going on in terms of the security situation. But to complicate things further, this year in particular, we've seen many incidents of violence in which there's no reporting even in the Chinese press. And oftentimes, Radio Free Asia's Uyghur language service is the one who will, you know, call local hospitals, call local police stations, and are able to provide the international community with some sort of knowledge about what's going on. But these aren't reported in the state-run press. I mean, just last month we had at least 18 people who died when some people attacked a checkpoint, a police checkpoint in Kashgar. And then, you know, there were reports that perhaps 30 people died. We're not sure. But there are also claims that the forces, police forces, were shooting at people indiscriminately. Now, there's really no way for the international community to verify these claims, which is one reason why, even though China does face security, a tough security situation, you know, we would often urge caution in cooperation with China with respect to anti-terrorism.
Underlying all those issues is the fact that Beijing has had trouble assimilating this minority group into China. Why has it been so difficult?
Well, I think, you know, that's a difficult question to answer. I think that in some ways, they have tried to improve things through economic growth in the region, and that's often been one of the main, you know, if you have a carrot and stick, which the stick often is the Strike Hard campaign and the rhetoric against violent terrorism and extremism. And then on the other hand, the carrot is economic growth and economic opportunities. But I think many Uyghurs feel that because of economic discrimination, you know, and the fact that a lot of the growth is going towards big infrastructure projects that are in many cases run by Chinese companies from, you know, inland China, that they're not able to benefit from the economic growth in the same way that locals are or Han Chinese are. Perhaps it's in part due to economic opportunities.
So one way that Beijing has tried to uplift the education level in Xinjiang is to introduce Mandarin language instruction as part of their patriotic education policy. Is this a good or bad thing in practice?
Well, I think that's a difficult thing to say. I mean, there have been critics. Uyghur groups abroad have criticized the bilingual education as saying that, you know, it's not bilingual in the sense that every ethnicity is learning the other's language, and that, you know, for example, Han students are becoming fluent in Uyghur and participating in Uyghur life to the same extent that Uyghur students are, you know, expected to assimilate into the mainstream of Han society. But on the other hand, I mean, there are some parents who perhaps want their children to learn Mandarin or want their children to go to, you know, universities in the interior and, benefit from economic opportunities. So I think that there's probably a range of opinions within the Uyghur community about the policies, but there are definitely concerns that it's one way that the government is trying to marginalize the Uyghur language and Uyghur culture.
I'm speaking today to William Ni, China researcher at Amnesty International. We're talking about the ethnic tension in China's Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. I'll ask William what Beijing can do to instill a sense of national identity and what avenue do dissident or Uyghur activists have to engage in a productive discourse with Beijing. Up next, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Eun-tik. If you've just joined us, today we're speaking to William Ni, China researcher at Amnesty International. You mentioned earlier about the economic carrot that also another policy is to introduce positive discrimination in that one-fourth of all state employees in Xinjiang must be Uyghur. Mm-hmm. Has this been implemented? Because you claim that most of the economic benefits are going towards large corporations that benefit the Han community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I would say at this point it's difficult to know. I mean, there are reports that employment discrimination against Uyghurs is fairly widespread, especially in the private sector. Just because you have a lot of companies, whether it's in Urumqi or other cities, who, the people and the money, the capital, perhaps comes from other areas in China. For example, you might have business people originally from Zhejiang who set up a business in Urumqi, and they feel that just because of it's more convenient, they would like to employ people who, they feel are culturally closer to them. So, I think that, but, on the other hand, there are reports that the government and the state sector are more willing to hire Uyghurs. So it's difficult to say. At the same time, we see that a lot of Uyghurs are choosing to stay on the farms and not migrate to the cities as much, perhaps in a way of social protest. But again, I mean, the research on this is somewhat limited.
That's a recurring theme, isn't it? It's very hard to get reliable information. Has it gotten more difficult to get first-hand information?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, this is really one of the key concerns in trying to, verify the facts with respect to these violent incidents. And if the government's, it's kind of ironic because if the government claims that there's a terrorist attack, one would expect that they would allow open reporting. And even to some extent, they did allow some more open access to, what happened in 2009. Of course, there, Amnesty International documented serious concerns about what happened in the riots on July 5th, 2009. But, at the time, they learned the lesson from what happened in Tibet in 2008 and allowed greater media access. But it looks like increasingly that's not the case. There was an incident last year where overseas Uyghur groups were saying that up to 1,000 people had died in confrontations, and internet communications were shut down in certain areas in the region. Given the limited internet connections sometimes that occur or cell phone communications and the fear that also many people have, this makes verifying events much more difficult.
What kind of president has Xi Jinping been to the Uyghur community?
Well, I think it's mixed in some ways. Right after there was the series of violent incidents, including the Kunming train station incidents, and then the incident at the Urumqi train station, and then the Urumqi market. They launched the Strike Hard campaign in May of 2014, last year, which prioritized striking hard, grabbing people quickly, sentencing them quickly, prosecuting them quickly. And but right after that, so I mean, this was the very hardline message. But at the same time, they had the second central work forum on Xinjiang, where the, you know, it seemed like the government was recognizing that there were some policy issues that were contributing to this, and they wanted to improve ethnic harmony, to give Uyghurs more economic opportunities. And there's quite a bit of rhetoric that came out of that that conference that would be positive. But, you know, of course, whether or not those policies have been implemented is really too early to say. What we do know is that in terms of respecting freedom of religion, there's been increasing crackdowns on that. You know, Urumqi passed regulations to ban veils this year. There's restrictions on Ramadan. Civil servants, teachers, and students are in many counties not allowed to observe the fasting. And also there's the new draft anti-terrorism law. So they've drafted a law specifically to target the issue. But, you know, the problem is that the definition of extremism is so wide and vague that, you know, just about anybody could be persecuted as an extremist. And it really doesn't meet international standards with respect to freedom of expression and association. So, you know, it seems like that they're building more tools of suppression and trying to crack down against people in the region. But also, you know, there's been a crackdown against human rights defenders, lawyers, and civil society across the board in China. So, you know, I think that has to be seen in context, that while it does seem like the suppression has increased in the Xinjiang region in general, you know, we also see a similar pattern of repression in China as well.
So if you are the president, for example, and you need to instill a sense of national identity, what can you do? I mean, language seems not received kindly by the community. Religion is something that it seems they're taking a hard line on. What else can the government do?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, Xi Jinping and the Chinese government has been trying to implement the rule of law. You know, this is one of the main goals of the government. And I think that this is one area where if they were to make laws in which Uyghurs and other Chinese people throughout China would have the ability to participate in the drafting of through public participation, and then, you know, have a fair and just legal system, you know, this could be one step that could help bridge the divide between communities. I think, you know, what Amnesty International has said is we urge the immediate non-conditional release of Ilham Tohti. You know, this was a person who was trying to bridge the cultural gap that was widening. And, you know, I think they need more people like Ilham Tohti to engage in dialogue, talk about grievances openly, decrease mistrust. You know, so I think that, you know, there are steps like that that could help in decreasing tension. But, you know, I think that just, you know, hoping that economic growth will be the sole factor in improving things is, you know, well, of course, it's important. People's livelihood issues are important, but it can't just be the sole thing that they're relying on.
Going forward, would dissidents like Ilham, what can they do? What avenues do they have? Because it seems like if you try the moderate approach, you get arrested as well. And it seems like there's no avenue for them to engage in a productive dialogue. And Uyghurs in exile seems to be speaking to the international community more than their government or even their community back home. So what can be done to improve relations forward? And even organizations like yours, Amnesty International, what role do you see yourself playing in improving this fraught relations?
Well, I mean, I think that, I mean, you've touched on a very difficult issue, and I don't know if there's necessarily any easy answers for Uyghur activists. I think one of the things that we've tried to do, and many overseas Uyghur organizations, and many Chinese people, Han Chinese as well, is try to encourage the government to recognize that there are policy concerns that many people like Ilham Tohti and others really have an issue with, and trying to recognize the problem rather than just ignoring it. For example, when the government of Turkey raised concerns about the fasting or people not being able to observe fast in the region, you know, the government quickly said, no, everybody in has the freedom of religion, and things are being done according to the law. And, you know, a lot of evidence shows that the government really believes that they feel like that they are taking care of violent terrorists, and that all their policies are justified. And I think unless they recognize that there are issues that are leading to some of the discontent, it'll be difficult to solve the issue. So that's one of the things that we're trying to do is document human rights violations and try to present them to the government in a way that hopefully they can take on board.
William, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking to William Ni, China researcher at Amnesty International, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.